Montana, I probably couldn't tell the difference.
I think you'd be able to tell the difference between mountains and wheat fields.
Okay.
So we're in Genesis 16. And before we jump into chapter 16, let's go back to the end of chapter 11 and get some background before we dive in here. So in chapter 11, we've got Abraham, their Terah, Haran, Lot, you know, they've all moved out. And verse 30, Moses says, Sarai was barren, she had no child. Okay. When we get into chapter 12, God makes the Abrahamic covenant. He promises Abram, verse 2, I will make you a great nation. But there's no kids yet. Verse 7, he says, to your descendants, I will give this land. But there's no kids. When we get into chapter 13, after Abram and Lot separate, verse 15, all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. But still no kids. And when we get into chapter 15, the beginning of the chapter, God says to Abram in verse 1, do not fear, Abram, I'm a shield to you, your reward shall be very great. And finally, Abram says, look, I have no kids. You've made all of these promises, make me a great nation, give my descendants this land, make my descendants as the dust of the earth. I have no kids. And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And finally, God says in 15:4, this man, Eliezer of Damascus, is not going to be your heir. One who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And then God tells him to look to the heavens and count the stars, you'll be able to count them, so shall your descendants be. Now, that statement here in 15:4, the way it's worded is extremely important, because it says, one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. There is no mention of Sarai in that promise. And when you compare this promise in 15 to the promise that God's going to make in 17, it's not until chapter 17 that God mentions Sarai. So here in 15, Sarai's not mentioned. Now, Abram should have assumed it's going to be with his wife. I mean, that should have been a no-brainer. But God didn't explicitly mention her yet. So when we get into chapter 16, Abram apparently related this promise to his wife. And again, Moses writes, Sarai had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. And we always assume that they acquired Hagar when Abram and Sarai were in Egypt in Genesis 12, maybe as a dowry from Pharaoh or whatever. But that's an assumption. She could have been acquired anytime before they went down to Egypt, anytime after Egypt. Because remember, traders were going through that country on a regular basis. go over to sometime just read Genesis 37. That's how Joseph got sold into slavery. Traders were passing by, and Judah said, hey, let's not kill him. Let's make a few bucks off of our brother. Let's sell him. So don't assume that Hagar came from Egypt when they were down there in Genesis 12. She could have come along at any point. So Sarai has this brilliant idea. First of all, she acknowledges that God had closed her womb and had prevented her from having kids. But it doesn't seem to occur to her that the one who had closed her womb and it prevented her from having kids could also open her womb and enable her to have children. It's like she never even thought of that at this point. So she chooses the culturally accepted option. So she's presuming that God can't do the impossible here, or it never even occurs to her that he can do the impossible. And so the culture in Abram's day provided the means for Abram to have an heir that could still be claimed as the son of Sarai, his wife. So if a woman couldn't bear children for her husband, it was acceptable for her to give him a female slave as a wife and then claim the child that resulted from that union. Think of what Jacob did. Rachel can't have kids, so Rachel gives Jacob Bilhah as a wife, and then Rachel claims for herself the children of Bilhah. And then same thing with Leah. God had eventually closed Leah's womb, and now she's jealous of her sister Rachel, so she gives Jacob Zilpah. And then when Zilpah has kids, Leah claims them and even names them as her own. So this is no different. And Abram listens, listens to Sarai, never bothers to seek the Lord in this matter, never bothers to weigh the consequences or the implications of what he's about to do. He simply listened to the voice of Sarai. The last time we heard that phrase was in Genesis 3, when God said to Adam, because you've listened to the voice of your wife, cursed is the ground because of you. Now, obviously, Abram didn't know that, but same thing. And the consequences are going to come along. So Sarah, her problem was presumption. Abram, his problem is passivity. He just passively accepts what his wife's solution is. Okay, sure, no problem. So after Abram lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maid, gave her to her husband as a wife. Now, Hagar would be the second wife, second class wife. Sarai still the first. She's still in charge. And even though Hagar is now Abram's wife, Hagar is still the maid of Sarai. So she's still a servant. She's going to forget that pretty quick. So he went into Hagar, she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress, Sarai, was despised in her sight. So she realizes she's pregnant, and she despises her mistress. She hates her. She's got this pride, this arrogant, I conceived and you couldn't. And she kind of forgot that she was still a slave. So Sarai, she turns against Abram. May the wrong done me be upon you. Like, okay, first of all, it was your idea. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw she conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. So Sarai wants the Lord to judge Abram for the wrong done to her by her maid Hagar. And I think in Sarai's mind, she's thinking, well, you know, Abram, you really should have thought about the consequences and the implications of my proposal, and you should have refused it. But you didn't. And she's refusing to accept any responsibility for the fact that all of this was her idea in the first place. And Abram just went along. So Abram, he takes the passive route again. Your maid's in your power. Do what is good in your sight. And so Sarai treats her harshly. I mean, Abram basically, during this entire situation, gives Hagar and her son back to a very angry and very vengeful Sarai. And she treats her harshly, which granted was legally permissible. I mean, the master could do essentially whatever they wanted with the slave. Wasn't morally acceptable, but it was legally permissible. And so finally, Hagar has enough and she escapes and flees into the wilderness. And her intent is not to get caught and never to return. Well, as she's fleeing, and keep in mind, Abram is there, he's down in the Negev area in the south of what would become Israel. And she's fleeing towards Shur, and Shur is basically a region in the northernmost part of the Sinai Peninsula. So she's fleeing basically back home to Egypt. She's heading back to familiar territory. Abram was in Hebron. She's heading south and west. She's trying to get home back to Egypt. And as she's fleeing, she comes to a spring of water in the wilderness, and the angel of the Lord finds her there. I don't like the word angel in this context because it gives us the wrong idea. The word angel in both Hebrew and Greek simply means messenger. And so in this particular context, I prefer the term the messenger of the Lord. And the messenger of the Lord here, this is not a messenger of the Lord. This is the messenger of the Lord. This is the pre-incarnate Christ. This is the second person of the triune God. And I want you to notice a couple things that are said about him and some things that he says. So in verse 10, the messenger of the Lord tells Hagar, I will greatly multiply your descendants. He doesn't say the Lord will do this. He says, I'm going to do this because he's God. I'm going to be the one who will multiply your descendants. Verse 13, Hagar calls him by the name of the Lord. So Hagar is calling the messenger of the Lord, Yahweh. And she says, you are a God who sees. So Hagar recognizes the deity of the angel of the Lord. He's the second person of the Godhead. I don't think she realized he was the second person, but she realizes this one who is speaking to me is God. And this is the first time that God speaks in this entire incident. The first six verses, when all of this started, God is absent. He was never considered by Sarai. He was never considered by Abram. He was never called upon. Now, he himself is directly intervening. He's stepping in. And also notice that God only speaks to Hagar. He never says anything in this chapter to Abram or to Sarai. It's only to Hagar that he speaks. So he asks her a question. Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? Now, obviously, he already knew where she had come from and where she was going. So he's not asking these questions to gain information. He already knows the answer. It's just like every time before this, like in Genesis 3, when God was speaking to Eve, and when God is speaking to Adam, and then in chapter 4, when God is speaking to Cain, he already knows the answer. He's not looking to gain knowledge. He's trying to elicit a response, an acknowledgement, a confession. So he asks her, where have you come from and where are you going? And she admits it. I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai. She's treated me harshly. She's making my life miserable. The way she treats me is a danger to my unborn child. I can't take this anymore. And once she admits that, the angel of the Lord or the messenger of the Lord says, yeah, I know that, and I want you to go back. I want you to return to your mistress. I want you to submit yourself to her authority. Your running away does not change your relationship to Sarai. She's still your mistress. You're still her maid. And it doesn't change your responsibility to her. She still has authority over you, and you need to submit. And it kind of reminds you of some of the things that Peter says in 1 Peter 2. And it fits this context perfectly. Peter says, servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. He could have simply quoted what he would inspire Peter to say 2,000 years later. Sarai or Hagar, be submissive to Hagar, Sarai, and I know she's unreasonable, submit to her authority. And with that instruction comes a promise. So he promises, I myself will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count. So I'm going to greatly multiply your descendants. What should be noted is the promise is made to Hagar, not to her son. Her son's not born yet. God makes this promise to Hagar. I'm going to multiply your descendants. Now, the promise would be fulfilled through her son. But the Lord makes the promise to Hagar. And there are overtones of the Abrahamic covenant here. Back in chapter 13, verse 16, he promises Abraham, I'm going to make your descendants like the dust of the earth, and you can't count the dust. In chapter 15, verse 5, I'm going to make your descendants like the stars, and you can't count the stars. And so he says to Hagar, I'm going to make your descendants so numerous you can't count them. Now, when Ishmael is born, in the next chapter, God makes this promise to Abraham about Ishmael and says in verse 20, I will bless him, make him fruitful, make him multiply him exceedingly. I'll make a great nation of him. And then in chapter 25, verses 12 to 18, you can look at the descendants of Ishmael. But here, the messenger of the Lord is making this promise specifically to Hagar about the son she's carrying. I'm going to greatly multiply your descendants. And then he goes on and he says, behold, you're with child and you're going to bear a son and you're going to name him Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. And Ishmael basically means God hears. God has given heed. And he describes him. He's going to be a wild donkey of a man. His hand is going to be against everyone. And you're going to see that very early on in life, the way he torments Isaac. And everyone's hand is going to be against him. And the last statement in verse 12, New American Standard, it just doesn't make sense. He will live to the east of all his brothers. That to me is just not a really good translation. King James, I don't think is a whole lot better. I think the better translation, given the context of this verse, is in like the NIV, he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. The Holman Christian Bible, he will live at odds with all his brothers. The New Living Translation, he will live in open hostility against all his relatives. The ESV and the RSV, he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. I think those thoughts are the way this verse shall end. He's going to be a wild donkey. He's going to be against everyone. Everyone's going to be against him. And he's going to live in hostility with all his brothers. People are going to hate him, and he's going to hate everybody else. Chapter 25, verse 18, the last part of the verse, he settled in defiance of all his relatives. So Ishmael is just he's going to be a defiant person. And you're going to see that as he's growing up. So she responds and calls the angel, the messenger of the Lord, by the name of the Lord. So she's identifying the messenger of the Lord as the Lord himself. And she says to him, you are a God who sees. So she recognizes the deity of the angel of the Lord. First of all, he knew who she was before she said anything. He knew where she had come from, where she was going. He says to her, you're Sarai's maid. So he knew that. He promises himself to multiply her descendants. So she recognizes by what he said who he is. This is God. This is the God who sees. And so here's one of the names of God, El Rohi, in the Old Testament. And then she says, have I even remained alive here after seeing him? She seems to be quite surprised that she's remained alive after having seen the Lord himself. Now, obviously she didn't see him in his unveiled, undiminished glory, because no one could do that and live. But she recognized that she's just been in the presence of God, and God has spoken to her. He's going to speak to Jacob. And he's actually going to wrestle with Jacob when we get into chapter 32. He speaks to Moses and some of the elders of Israel. He eats with them on Mount Sinai. Gideon has an encounter with the Lord. Manoah and Mrs. Manoah has the same encounter. And he even says, we're going to die. We've seen God. And his wife says, look, if he had wanted to kill us, do you actually think he would have accepted an offering from us? Quit panicking. So she named the well Bir Lahai Roi, which means the well of the living one who sees me. And it's between Kadesh and Bered. And those are two locations in the Negev, in the desert, in the southern part of what would become Israel. And what's interesting is Isaac actually spends quite a bit of time at this well. You see Isaac there in chapter 24, verse 62, and you see him there again in chapter 25, verse 11. So he actually lives near this well. So Hagar goes back and bears a son. So eventually, after returning and submitting to Sarai, she gives birth, and she must have related to Abram her encounter in the wilderness with the messenger of the Lord and his instructions to name the son Ishmael, because that's what Abram names it. So she probably, okay, this is what happened to me in the wilderness. I had this encounter with the Lord, and he says I'm going to have a son, and I'm going to name him Ishmael. And Abram says, okay, I'm not going to argue with that. So Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Now, back in chapter 12, he was 75 years old when he departed from Haran and came into the land of Canaan. So 11 years have elapsed from the time he left Haran to the time that Ishmael is born. Another 14 years are going to elapse before Isaac is born. Now, what's going to happen? I want to add a few things that take place between chapter 16 and chapter 17. So keep in mind that Abram's assuming that the covenant that God had promised him was going to go through Ishmael. He's assuming that, and God never said otherwise. God simply said back in chapter 15 that one that is going to come forth from your body is going to be your heir. And then right after that statement, God ratifies the Abrahamic covenant. So now here's Ishmael. He's the firstborn son of Abram. And Abram rightly assumed that the promise was going to come through his firstborn son. So now that the covenant has an heir, I think Abram felt that, hey, I'm still in the prime of my life. You know, the fact of the matter is he's not going to die until 175. It's at this point that he decides to marry another woman, Keturah. And he takes some concubines and has some other children. And Moses relates this in Genesis 25. And a lot of commentaries put the incident with Keturah and the concubines between chapter 16 and chapter 17. And one of the reasons they do that is when you look at the birth order as they're described in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, the birth order is Ishmael, then the sons of Keturah, then Isaac. So Abram thought, okay, I've got my firstborn, I've got the heir of the covenant, I'm still in the prime of my life. You know, it would be nice to have other kids, and Sarai can't have any kids, so, and I certainly don't want to get involved with Hagar again, because that really messed things up. So he marries another woman who's not under Sarai's authority and takes some other concubines, and he has some kids. In fact, he has six sons through Keturah. So during this 13 years between the end of 16 and the beginning of 17. So 16 ends, Abram's 86, 17 begins, Abram's 99. So in that 13-year gap, he has other children with Keturah and a bunch of concubines. Now, the reason Moses did not put that account at this point is because Keturah, her sons, the concubines, their sons, they're irrelevant to the flow of the covenant story. The flow of the covenant story is with Ishmael and Isaac. The other sons, they're irrelevant to that flow. So Moses sticks them at the very end of Abram's life, just almost mentions them in passing because they're really not relevant to the flow of the story. Okay, so he's got all these kids now. When you get into chapter 17, and I just want to mention a few things. I don't want to step on any toes with the person doing 17, but the first half of chapter 17, 13 years after Ishmael is born, after Abram marries Keturah and takes some concubines and has some children with them, he still believes that the covenant is going to go through Ishmael. So the first 8 verses, God is reestablishing the covenant. I'm going to establish my covenant between me and you. I'm going to multiply you exceedingly. Verse 4, as for me, behold my covenant with you. You'll be the father of a multitude of nations. Your name's not going to be Abram anymore. I'm going to change it to Abraham. I've made you a father of a multitude of nations. You're going to be exceedingly fruitful. I'm going to make nations of you. Kings are going to come free with you. I'm going to establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants. He's still thinking this is all about Ishmael. God hasn't said otherwise yet. Throughout your generations, it's going to be an everlasting covenant. I'm going to be your God and the God to your descendants. I'm going to give you and your descendants the land of your sojournings, so on and so forth. And beginning in verse 9, he brings in the covenant of circumcision, the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. But up to this point, Abraham's still thinking, this is all about Isaac. I mean, not Isaac, Ishmael. God hasn't said anything to the contrary yet. But all of a sudden, when you get to verse 15, God springs a surprise. Abram, guess what? You're going to have another son. And this time, it's going to be with your wife, Sarai. So he says in verse 15, as for Sarai, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah, and I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. This is the first time that Sarah comes into play bearing a child. And it kind of throws a monkey wrench in everything Abraham was assuming about Ishmael. And he's 99 years old. And so he says to God in verse 17, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to give you a son by her. Or sorry. Abram fell on his face and laughed. Like, are you kidding? I'm 99 years old. She's 90. She's never had kids. I'm beyond the prime of my life. I'm beyond the ability to father children. And this is where the statement in Romans 4 comes in. So Romans 4, 18 to 20, this is where that statement should be inserted, where he says he contemplated his own body now as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old and the deadness of Sarah's womb. So God, all of a sudden, he promises another son through Sarah, and he's thinking, you've got to be kidding me. A child's going to be born to 100-year-old man, my wife's 90, my body's as good as dead, nothing's working anymore. And yet, Paul says in Romans, he didn't waver in unbelief, he grew strong in faith, and he believed, okay, I find it amusing, he says, he's laughing, Sarah laughs in the next chapter, but if you say so. So, even though God promises a son and really hasn't said anything about the covenant, I think Abram is assuming now that the covenant is going to be taken away from Ishmael and is going to be given to the son of Sarah. And what he says in verse 18 makes me think that he still wants the covenant to remain with his firstborn. Oh, that Ishmael might live before you. He's my firstborn. And God says, no. Sarah, your wife, is going to bear a son, and you're going to name him Isaac, and I'm going to establish my covenant with him. So God, he puts his foot down. The covenant is coming through Isaac. But because Ishmael is your firstborn, I will bless him. I've heard you. I'm going to bless him. I'll make him fruitful and multiply him exceedingly, become the father of 12 princes, make him a great nation. So there's this whole convoluted thing going on between with Ishmael and with the covenant and Abraham making all sorts of assumptions that God finally has to clarify. The covenant is going to come through the son who is going to be born of Sarai. And finally, the light bulb goes on and, okay. Well, had I known that earlier, I probably wouldn't have done some of the stupid things I did. But now that they're done, God is still going to take care of everything. Even though, in Abram's mind, even though I screwed up royally, God is still going to take care of things. God's promises are still going to be fulfilled. Everything he has told me he's going to do, he will do. Wasn't as I expected, but he's going to do it. And this is where Romans 4, with respect to the promise of God, he didn't waver in unbelief. He grew strong in faith, and he was fully assured that what God had promised, even though it seemed highly unlikely, he was able to perform. So that is chapter 16. Any questions?
Hey, Jeff, that was really a busy time for Abraham Mullen in 20 verses.
Yeah. He covered a lot of territory.
Jeff, yeah. I have a question. We're looking at Zechariah and Elizabeth mm-hmm. in the New Testament on Thursday morning. The response of the Lord to Zechariah with his doubt. Abraham isn't demonstrating doubt here, or is he when he laughs?
I think he probably was demonstrating some doubt, just like Sarah does in chapter 18. The difference between Abraham and Zacharias is nothing like this has ever happened in the time of Abraham. And so Zacharias should have known what God was able to do from the story of Abraham, and he should not have doubted.
Thank you.
Yep.